Okay, folks, let's get going on another set of readings now. We got another four people wanting to read, so we got an excellent lot this evening. First reader, please.
Evening, my name's Steve Tanner. First time reading out in public for my works after 10 years on and off of working. I've been writing a trilogy called A Question of Faith for a long while now. I've finished two of the books. This is the introduction of one of the protagonists about halfway through the first book, a young lady called Roa Denon. Chapter 13, Robes of the Holy Order, the Priory in Garantham. Roa Denon finished scrubbing the stone slab. Her knees hurt, her stomach hurt, and her leg hurt. She was determined to do a good job. As she turned to dip her brush into the bucket, she was horrified to find Sister Gaitel standing in the way. She froze. They both watched as dirty water dripped down onto her shoe. "For Bull's sake," the sister exclaimed, "watch what you're doing." Roa Denon grabbed a cloth to dry it. "Well, my apologies, I didn't see you," the sister scowled. "Sometimes I wonder why the prioress ever took you under her wing." She jerked her foot away. "This time you've just gone too far." Roa Denon lowered her cloth. "I'm sorry, sister, truly, it won't happen again." Sister Gaitel's face took on a look of triumph. "My dear, I'm not talking about your sloppiness. I'm talking about being late for sext." Rodan's mouth dropped. Sext, the third of the little hours of divine office, was recited on the sixth hour every day. It was written in the rules. When the bell sounded, it was done. Baal, their god, commanded it. Surely she'd not missed it. "Ah, you should look appalled. Perhaps sister convinced the prioress that your calling was a mistake after all." But sister," her voice was shaky, I didn't hear the bell." A grin blossomed upon Sister Gaitel's face. "The bell's being repaired. If you'd bothered to check, you'd have known. Now get up. We need to go see the prioress." She couldn't believe it. "At once, sister." She reached out to grab hold of the bucket. "Leave it. Make haste and follow now." Sister Gaitel turned and stormed off. Roa Denon almost dropped the bucket in the haste to do the sister's bidding. She struggled to get up before she brushed herself down. Seeing the sister marching away, she ran to catch up. Sister Gaitel was so wrapped up in herself, she failed to notice the distinct limp that Roa Denon tried to hide as she scurried along. Like most girls who joined the priory, Roa Denon had been placed in the convent by devoted parents while still young. In the years that followed, she had immersed herself in the daily rituals of the robes of the Holy Order, eventually coming to love and respect what they did. Following the daily devotions, she'd come to realise that not all life was brutal. Good did exist. So she made up her mind to stay. Not because of the wishes of her family, but because she felt they'd found a true calling. So she worked hard at the devotions and gave of her best. From a well-to-do family, the prior received a dowry, along with herself from her parents, plus some jewellery bequested to her by a late great-aunt. After a month of testing, she'd taken a vow of obedience. She had so far served 5 years as an office. In less than two more, she'd be allowed to take her final solemn vow, to become a nun and serve Baal for the rest of her life, to hear their god personally welcome her into his fold. She couldn't wait, but she still had two more years. She worried he may not reveal himself to her. Was Sister Gaitel right? Was she devout enough? Was she fully committed? She knew long ago that the sister had not taken to her, but she'd tried her best to please. She was a hard taskmistress, totally dedicated to the order. So she drove all the novices hard, to test them, she said. But no matter how hard Roa Denon tried, nothing seemed to satisfy her. She sighed. They were outside Prior Sweetall's office. Sister Gaitel knocked on the imposing door.
Okay, thanks very much, and apologies about the strange noises coming out of the pub speakers. Did we get any answer on that? Somebody's baby alarm or something like that? Okay. Yep, anyway, let's get on with things. I do believe that the next one is me. So, I'm Cheryl Morgan, and this is the start of a story called Snow White's Wedding. "She's a bitch and a cow and I hate her!" Princess Snow White stamped her foot. Then she picked up some embroidered cushions and began to throw them at the racks of dresses she had been trying on, screaming with anger as she did so. Finally, fury spent, she sat down on the now cushionless sofa and began to cry. Her lady-in-waiting and best friend forever, Rose Red, came and sat beside her. "It's okay, Snow," she said. "Mom and I will take care of it. The wedding will be wonderful, I promise." "Oh, Rose, you and your mum have been so good to me," Snow said between sobs. "But you shouldn't have to do this. I'm the one who's getting married. Dad's been great. He always gives me money for everything I want. But it's my mother who should be in charge of all the arrangements, not yours." "She's not your mother, though, is she? That's the problem, I guess." "Yeah, stepmothers, who needs them? Except kings have to have wives for ceremonial purposes. At least, that's how Dad explained it to me when he remarried. I think, anyway. I mean, I was only 5 at the time. I just wanted my real mom back." "Well," said Rose, "you'll be free of her soon. You'll have your own home, a husband, and in due course, a kingdom to rule." "I know, but what a start. I mean, I didn't really expect Dad to come. He's always busy being kingly somewhere. Never has any time for anyone. But a girl should at least be able to rely on her mother to attend her wedding. All that Queen Bitch can say is that she and Prince Rupert's father don't get on, so it would be better for her not to go. I bet she just can't bear to see me happy." "It's a bit rude, too, isn't it? I mean, shouldn't there be, like, some sort of diplomacy?" "Yeah, right. Dad says that Mordok is one of the richest kingdoms around. Apparently, he's getting a really big dowry for me. I mean, not only is Prince Rupert rescuing me from Mum's clutches, he's even paying for the privilege. The least my parents could have done is turn up for the ceremony. Oh well, I guess we'll have to be responsible adults and do our bit for the kingdom. At least we are not going to let Fantasia down. Now, let's go over it again." Rose got out a long list and began going through it, ticking off items with her quill. "Wedding dress, check. Bridesmaid's dress? We settled on rose pink? Of course, it looks so good on you. Check. Hairstyles and makeup agreed and practiced. Check. Court dress for each of us. Check. Trunkload of everyday dresses until we can find a good seamstress in Mordok. Check. Jewellery. Check. Shoes. Check. Princess's favourite toy rabbit. Check. My loot. Check. Diet plan. Should we go over that again? I guess we should. I expect chocolate and champagne at the wedding, but until then, I need to be careful. Can't afford to be too fat for my wedding dress. Oh, thanks, Snow. I'm fine doing your hair and makeup, but the thought of having to make alterations to that dress gives me nightmares." "You know what gives me nightmares, Rose?" "Your mom?" "No, the thought of having to face this without you by my side." "Oh, Snow. That's one nightmare you need never worry about coming true, I promise." All right, Will.
I've actually prepared a piece, and on the way here I've managed to drop it. That's, so instead, I'm going to give you a warning. A warning not just to the writers, but to those who are daft enough to try and live with them. It's called Hatchet. Type, type, type. That's all she did. All day long. Type, 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 bloody type. What she had to type about, I've no idea. But I suppose somebody must have had an idea, because she told me something about Hatchet and a contract. Now me, I'm a carpenter. I know about contracts. You have a contract, you go to work, you get paid at the end of the week, at the end of the month. Her contract with Hatchet? I never saw no money coming in from a contract with Hatchet. Just type, 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 bloody type. Well, this day, it all went a bit wrong. You see, I'd been out since 5 o'clock in the morning. Working hard, because she brought no money in. She might be there all day long. She might be there in the evening. Sometimes even to the night, I'd hear the rattle of her keyboard in her study, going type, type, type. But I came home tired. There's no food made. She was there in her study, type, type, type. I went through the cupboards. There's no food there. I can't make anything because she hasn't been shopping. Just type, 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 bloody type. So I went into the study and she's there at the computer. I said, "You've got to give this up." And she said, "I've got a contract. I've got hatchet." Well, I had a hatchet in my belt from work. And I brought it down straight across her hands on the keyboard. And afterwards, of course, I was sorry. And I bound them up and we put them in ice and I ran off to the hospital. We'll just have to see if the surgeon can save her hands. We just got to wait and see. But that night when I got home and I lay in bed, there from her study, I could hear it. Type, type, type. I went back into the living room and I poured a big glass of whiskey, biggest glass I could find, drank it, and went into the study. I pulled out all the leads and all the plugs from the computer and went back to bed. Pulled the covers over my head and still it was there. Type, type, type. How could the keyboard do that? It wasn't plugged in. The computer wasn't plugged in. Type, 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 type. I poured another glass of whiskey. I drank it off. I went back into the study. And the keyboard was there, rattling. I walked round to her chair and I leant forwards, looking at the screen. There were words there. How could there be words there? It wasn't even plugged in. I leant forwards to read them because I'm a bit short-sighted from all the years of looking at a ruler. My hands were on the keyboard. I looked at the screen and it read, "Come inside." I couldn't take my hands from the keyboard. They wouldn't move from the keyboard. And now, here I am, looking through the monitor from the inside, looking out. How do I get out? This email has been sent to you from an unknown source. If you do not recognise the sender and you are not intended to receive it, please delete the email unread. Thank you. Be warned.
Hello, I'm Jonathan L. Howard, and this is a bit from an unpublished novel. And I shan't give you any background. You're all moderately intelligent people, I'm sure you can figure it out yourself. It's called Heart of the Empire. "Are you carrying any weapons?" the guard asked. "Yes," replied Jack Fleming. "Is that a matter for concern?" "No weapons are permitted in the room, sir," said the guard, his eyes never wavering from straight ahead. Then he turned abruptly and picked up a deep steel tray that reminded Fleming of a Lidler safety deposit box. "Please place any weapons, sharp items, drugs, or any items that may be considered contraband in the designated container, sir." It was not a request. Smiling good-naturedly, Fleming drew his .38 automatic from its concealed belt holster and placed it carefully on the steel surface. Then he braced his foot on the side of the table to draw the double-barreled Derringer from his ankle holster. This was a new addition to his wardrobe. The adventure of the Swan of Avon had finally convinced him of the practicality of carrying more than one gun. The guard made to take the tray to his colleague waiting by the door, but Fleming stopped him. He fumbled with his left shirt cuff for a moment and produced a long, flat throwing knife from its scabbard strapped to his inside wrist. This was also new, but in this case because it was a replacement. Its predecessor had ended up in the ribs of the unhappy third member of the gang that had stolen the train. The body had been recovered, but the knife must have been thrown clear while the corpse was bouncing along the ballast in the train's wake. The guard watched the knife clack into the tray with an acid glare, as if Fleming was some sort of weapon conjurer, sent to personally complicate the guard's working day. "Is that all, sir?" he said with an undertone of, "It had better be." "Yes," said Fleming mildly. "No. I almost forgot." He hefted his umbrella. "I'm not sure this will fit in your tin box, though." "The box is stainless steel, sir, and your umbrella can safely be stored on the hat rack." but it's a weapon. It may be usable as an impromptu weapon, sir, but we have to draw the line somewhere. Now, I mean, Fleming twisted the handle and pulled. A chamber opening was revealed from which tumbled a 10-bore shotgun cartridge into his waiting hand. He dropped the cartridge into the tray, closed the chamber with a click, and handed the unloaded umbrella to the guard. "There you go," he said. "That should be safe for the hat rack now." The guard gazed upon him with the eye of a basilisk. "You will not touch the prisoner. You will give nothing to the prisoner. You will accept nothing from the prisoner. You will stay on the indicated safe side of the room at all times. If you cross the line, the guards will enter the room and your interview will be terminated immediately." "Oh, I'm sure everything will be tickety." "No, sir. If you break any of these rules, everything will not be tickety-boo. Things will be the antithesis of tickety-boo. The prisoner has escaped twice before. The prisoner will not be allowed to escape again. We will shoot if we have to." It all seems a trifle extreme. "It may well seem that way to you, but our concern is that that prisoner stays in this institution no matter what. Are we clear, sir?" The guard led him to the interview room door. As he laid his hand upon the handle, he paused and looked narrowly at Fleming. "Those were all your weapons, weren't they, sir?" Fleming made a show of thinking about it. "I'm fairly sure." The guard sighed, muttered, "On your head be it, sir," and opened the door. Feeling a little less cheery than the air he affected, Fleming entered. The interview room was the size of an indoor tennis court and approximately as intimate. The end of the room that Fleming had entered was painted a dirty, patchy powder blue, as if somebody hadn't stirred the pot properly before dipping a paintbrush. The other end was an unthreatening terracotta red. Along the interface between the two colours was a band of yellow that ran clean across the floor, up the wall, across the ceiling, and back down the opposing wall to complete the circuit. Such effort had been made in painting the yellow line, it was as if there was a superstitious hope that it would create some sort of mystical barrier to separate the good and the holy at the blue end from the debased and sinful in the red. In the red half of the room was a heavy table. Large iron brackets held the feet securely and were themselves riveted to the floor. It would take an impressive trial of strength to shift that table even 1/10 of an inch. The tabletop was bare but for a brace of iron staples, and through these ran a chain connecting a pair of manacles. The prisoner sat behind the table, wrists firmly locked into them. "Hello, Jack," said the prisoner. "I was hoping it might be you. Don't suppose you can help a girl out, can you?"
Okay, that's our lot of readings for this evening. We'll take one more short break and then we'll see if we can manage to do a Q&A.